be damned if the same politicians who refused to act then are going to try to come back today.
The real content of any kind of revolutionary thrust lies in the principles and the goals that you're striving for.
When the powerful use their position to bully others, we all lose.
A system of justice will be the richer for diversity of background and experience.
I've been noticing that it's like very sensitive. You can hear me like screaming on some of the other.
Maybe it's not sensitive. Maybe you're just very
really loud. Okay. Yeah. Facts. All right. Caitlin, here we are. It's time for a new episode.
Here we are. I haven't had coffee today.
I don't know. I'm having your coffee from days ago.
Don't admit that. That's gross.
It's just been sitting on the floor. But I figure it's cold in the studio, so it's like it's getting refrigerated.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Oh, God. Okay, here we go. She's a woman! Hello, everybody. It's me, Miss Cracker. I'm here with my co-pilot, Caitlin, and it's time for She's a Woman. It's a podcast for every human being who looks in the mirror and says, "She's a woman!" And for the people who love them. Every week, we talk to incredible women of all kinds from all walks of life and invite them to share their stories with you, our incredible listeners. And that's exactly what we're going to do today. How are you doing today, Caitlin?
I'm excited for this interview today.
Oh, I know. I'm really excited for this
interview. It's almost Christmas time as of when we're recording this, I guess.
Right.
So
it's almost Christmas time. We have a good interview lined up for today.
2020 is almost over.
2020 is almost over. I want to just repeat that until my mouth gets dry because it's been the absolute worst year ever. And even though it was raining today and we had to haul a bunch of wigs and boxes and luggage through the rain, now we're in the safety of our nice studio and we're going to have a really great day.
That's right. And we're going to get coffee later.
And we're going to get coffee later. Anyway, Caitlin, I want to dive right into our serious, groundbreaking interview. But first, I have a little treat for you.
Okay.
Every week, we do a little segment called Here's the Good News, where we share positive stories torn from the headlines. The idea is that they'll bring you, our listeners, a little hope during these difficult times. And this week, the good news is all about women's rights. Period.
Came up with that yourself. You were like sitting here in anticipation of saying that joke.
Yeah, absolutely. I came up with it in the shower and I was like, oh, it's going in the podcast. Okay, so here's the good news. Scotland just approved a bill that will help make period products free to anyone who needs them.
Which is huge news.
Which is very huge news.
And sort of ridiculous that it's taken this long for even one country to approve it.
Because they're going to be the first in the world.
Yeah.
According to the BBC, members of Scotland's parliament, that's what MSP means, I learned. MSP kept showing up in the article. I'm like, what?
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah, I know. This is why we don't work for the BBC.
Exactly. So members of Scotland's Parliament approved the period products free provision Scotland bill in response to an urgent need. Too many people can't afford or access suitable period products. With average periods lasting 5 days, it can cost up to £8 a month for tampons and pads. And if you convert that to American dollars, that's $1 million. Some struggle to afford the cost. In fact, a survey of more than 2,000 people found that 1 in 4 respondents at school, college, or university in Scotland had struggled to access period products. So right now in Scotland, tampons, pads, and some reusable products are funded in schools and colleges and universities, but they will be made more broadly available from greater varieties of outlets in the coming years, and that's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I think it's really well overdue. If we can afford to like have box fulls of condoms to hand out at bars,
right,
then why can't we afford, you know, to have free tampons and pads in the bathrooms and stuff?
That's what I was thinking.
I mean?
Yeah, and I was also thinking like, you know, we make toilet paper free, and the whole reason that we do that is so that people can be safe and healthy.
Walking around with, like, poop exactly. in their underwear yeah. or whatever.
Right, exactly.
And so it's only fair.
Right. It's not the exact same thing, but it definitely stands to reason that if we want to provide things to keep people safe and healthy and happy that are absolutely essential that you biologically absolutely need, that I yeah. think tampons definitely fall under that, even more than condoms.
Absolutely. Also, yeah. I feel like it's, like, easier for men to get, like, Viagra for cheap and stuff, you know what I mean, than it yeah. is for, like, women or anyone that has a period, I should say,
yeah.
to get tampons or pads.
Right. I don't know. I think this is one of the things that I've been thinking about with you, like, while we're on the road and you're on a bus full of a bunch of gay men.
Do you think that there's any period products thought about on that bus at all no. or kept in the bathroom or kept in storage? No. Yeah. I have to, like, always figure it out for myself, which is, like, fine because that's yeah. what I'm used to. But it's, like, wouldn't it be nice if, like, even a tour bus bathroom had, like under the sink along with extra toilet paper also had yeah. feminine products? You know what I mean?
Because that's the thing that this bill is doing. I think what it's doing is it's changing the expectation so that people expect there to be free period products the same way that there's toilet paper. And exactly. it's not just about the law itself, but it's changing people's mindset about it.
Of course it's Scotland because we love Scotland.
We love Scotland.
Yeah.
So Scotland, you know, Caitlin and I are both unmarried and we're looking for citizenship.
Right. So anyone that's listening to this
yeah.
lives in Scotland.
Yeah. And if you are. And
specifically in, I'm going to mess up this pronunciation.
Edinburgh?
Edinburgh? Oh, someone let us know. Edinburgh?
Edinburgh. Edinburgh. Edinburgh.
Oh, God. Specifically, if you live there, marry me, you know?
Exactly.
I promise to learn how to pronounce the name.
But anyway, let this be an inspiration to the world. I hope that our government and many others yeah. follow suit and that we think of period products as an essential need for every human being to have access to and not just, I don't know what we think of them now, like a luxury item, I guess.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, so we're going to take a little break and then we're going to come right back.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Okay, we're back. And now it is time for our amazing interview. And boy, do we have a guest for you guys
Who's
today.
Who's the guest today?
Today, the guest is Rachel Bloom. And I am so excited. We've been waiting to hear back from her people. You know, our people contacted her people. And I have to say that I looked down at my page when I was writing questions and I couldn't think of what to write because I have so many things that I want to talk about. All right, let's dive in.
Yeah.
I'm going to introduce you, everybody. Okay, this is a very exciting day. I'm not a fan of many things because I'm a fan of myself above all, but I am a fan of our guest today, Rachel Bloom. She is perhaps best known for her TV show, Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, which tells the story of a young woman coming to terms with her mental health while desperately chasing after one of her exes. That's the best way I can come up with to summarize it, but there's a lot going on because somehow along the way, her bizarre story teaches us about mental illness, gender and sexuality, women's rights, Jewish guilt, pretzel making, and much, much more. But now that the TV show is all wrapped up, Bloom has written a book. It's called I Want to Be Where the Normal People Are. And I've had a chance to read it. So let's just say this for sure. Rachel Bloom is far from normal. Rachel, thank you so much for joining me today. How are you doing on this fine afternoon for you?
Well, I am ironically in the closet. I'm tucked away in my closet where the sound is best. I'm good. It's so lovely. Before we started recording, I was just telling you how great you were on All Stars and talking.
Thank you.
You're just great. I'm so happy to be talking to you. And that was a perfect summary of Crazy Ex.
Okay. And
first of all, super appreciative whenever anyone doesn't call it my Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, because that happens about half the time I do any podcast or anything. But also, I know that you're such a genuine fan. I mean, you showed up at our finale literally dressed in the season 2 theme song outfit, and you looked fantastic.
Cosplayed out, yeah.
It was so awesome, and I'm so happy to be here talking to you.
It was really amazing to go to that event because I get to see a lot of different kinds of fans of things, and I have to say that the fans of our Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, let's call her, are so warm and excited. And like you said, it's ladies in Deathly Hallows t-shirts just there to have a really great time. So that's something that you created. You created an environment for really nice people to come together. So you should be proud of that.
I am. I really love our fan base. They are so smart, and they're all different types of people, but I think the thing that binds them all together, and I include myself in that, is this feeling of being somehow an outsider outside the status quo or the normal, and I really miss performing live and meeting all those people.
On the other side of that, one thing you probably don't miss is having to do interviews about the show in person. Like you were saying, people call it My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And then one of the things you mentioned in your book is that reporters will ask you, have you ever been a crazy ex-girlfriend? And what do you think people are trying to get to with that question when they're asking it again and again and again?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, it's a very high class problem to be like, ugh, no one ever gets the name of my television show right. You know, people have bigger problems. It's really hard, I imagine, to be an entertainment journalist because there's so much competition. The pay is getting worse and worse and worse, I know.
Yeah.
Because most of them are working freelance. And so what you're trying to do is you're just trying to get a sound, but you're trying to get something, I think, buzzy so that people will click on the article or read the article. And so I think by asking, like, have you ever been a crazy ex-girlfriend? The hope is, they'll get me to say something like, yeah, no, I straight up set a guy's house on fire. Headline.
Yes, exactly.
Right. Headline. Crazy Ex-Girlfriend's Rachel Bloom used to be an arsonist, right?
Right. I think you're right that what they want to drive at is that they want to get that soundbite that says that Rachel Bloom is a crazy person, which is funny. They don't really need that soundbite. Now they have this entire book that you've written. And that's kind of what I wanted to talk about a little bit. I like my first question that I wrote down while reading the book is, Rachel, aren't you ashamed of yourself?
No.
And what I mean by that is, like, in your book, you are so frank about how not normal you were as a kid. You talk about poop and OCD and lies, and all those three things come together at times. And I just wanted to know, I think I know the answer for myself, but what is the point of writing about the things that make you abnormal? Like, what's the message that you're trying to send by exposing yourself as abnormal? What are you telling people?
Because what I've learned is that anything you think is abnormal about yourself, if you really tell people, okay, here's this thing about myself, here's why I feel this way, think this way, why this thing happened to me, you'll start to realize you're not that abnormal, that there's actually quite a high bar for you've been the only person on earth to be in this situation. So for example, like the story about my OCD that I tell, it involves like my poop and stuff. Sure, maybe I'm like the one person who like specifically their OCD started with like a poop based story of paranoia. But the underlying issue, which is I had a series of intrusive thoughts and I felt like I could only purge my guilt by telling my mother.
Yeah.
I've since had people say I had that. Like they're like, oh, yeah. When I was in middle school, I had that same thing. I had these guilty thoughts about different things and I felt like I had to purge them. And so you're not that special in what you think might be abnormal about you. And that's made me feel better. The more I kind of share with the world, I find the more the world echoes back to me. Oh yeah, same. I've been through that too. And I find that very comforting. So I think that the sharing to me, the oversharing, I get back what I share. And what I get back is like, you're not alone. And that's really helpful to me. And then I think it helps other people too.
Right.
To read that they can, if they read about my shame or they can read about my kind of deep, dark semi-secrets, that it can help them feel less ashamed and less alone.
Yeah, I think that's one of the powerful things about the book for me, without talking about the specifics, is that at first you're like, oh, I take this at face value. She's weird. And then by the end, you're like, oh no, we have a lot in common. And that's actually a good journey. That's actually a really great journey to go through.
Good.
I feel like we have a companion in all of this. Speaking of companionship, I felt a lot of echoes in my own life because you talked about one of my favorite hobby horse topics, which is being Jewish as a kid. And you were the kind of Jewish that I was, which is you don't know any Hebrew, but you definitely know all the names of celebrities that have used slurs against you. Like, yes. And so I wanted to know, do you feel like being a Jewish person like contributed to some of the feelings that you had of being an outsider?
Yes. And I think that for a lot of it, it was like I was an outsider anyway. And so being Jewish was just one more thing. And in a way, engaging in like Jewish humor and being like, dadle, 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 made me feel...
That's my favorite one.
Yeah, dadle, dadle, dadle. Made me feel like, okay, well, there's a reason I'm an outsider. Even though that wasn't the case. For the most part, I was an outsider and it had nothing to do with being Jewish, but because we talked about it a lot in the house and because we talked about it being othering for us. And I grew up with some Jews, but not a ton. And there was definitely a moment in high school where a lot of people I was in drama club with were going to this kind of one mega church near my house.
Yeah, right.
And they kept trying to get me to come to youth group. And my mom was like, you're not, and I was like, can I just go to youth group? They said they wanted me there to sing with them. And my mom was like, no, they're trying to convert you. Yeah. And I was like, no, they're not. And then I was on AOLIM talking to my friend and I was like, my mom won't let me come to youth group. She thinks you're trying to convert me or something. And it was like silence. And I went, are you trying to convert me? And this guy went, Rachel, you're just such a nice person. And like, it breaks my heart that you're going to go to hell. And I realized, oh shit. Oh, this is like a thing. Like all of the kind of things that my parents and especially grandparents had talked about because I heard them talk about feeling like an other for being Jewish. And I hadn't necessarily, I was an other for many things, you know? But I was like, oh shit, there is an othering that's happening that I'm not aware of because we're in California. We're not in like the South. No one's going to like openly ask me where my horns are.
Right.
But behind my back, like, yeah, they're saying I'm going to go to hell, which was like more subtle than what my grandpa grew up in Brooklyn with, I think, only Jews. My grandmother had grown up in St. Louis with like, you know, in these kind of Jewish sections of cities. But my father had grown up in a mostly Irish Catholic and Italian Catholic section of Boston. So he didn't grow up around a lot of Jews. I think that a lot of the humor around being Jewish, it's about feeling like an other. And that's what made me connect to it. And it always made me connect to it. It always made me, I was always fascinated with being a Jew and always fascinated. I dropped out of Hebrew school when I was like 10, but I never stopped this fascination with the culture. I was always very, very into the culture. I'm always very into like searching my ancestry. And then the man I married grew up so incredibly Jewish. He grew up going to, you know, what's called, you know, this like a yeshiva. So he went to an all Jewish private school until eighth grade. He straight up didn't know anyone non-Jewish for the first 13 years of his life. He grew up kosher. They would turn off the lights on Halloween. He didn't celebrate Halloween because it's a pagan holiday. So he only celebrated Purim, which is like the great tragedy of his life, I think. And like, actually, he doesn't know when Christmas is. My husband still forgets. He's like, Christmas is like the 23rd. Like he doesn't know that it's on the fucking 25th. And he asked me the other day because we have a, you know, a 9-month-old baby. He was like, hey, what are we going to tell her about Santa Claus? Like when you grew up around Christian kids, do you have to keep Santa Claus secret? And I don't know about you. It was surprisingly not a thing for me. Like I remember one time in one show and tell, one girl was like, I got this necklace from Santa. And in my head being like, you're a fucking idiot. But I never told her that.
Yeah. By the way, when you said that, I was like, yeah, he should know it's on the 24th. And then you said the 25th. I was like, oh no, I'm one of those Jews. I know they had the 24th is important too. That's Christmas Eve. I wasn't completely off. Being a Jewish kid definitely makes you have those experiences, whether you are coming from Orthodox community or Reform. You have those experiences of where, like you said, people telling you that you're going to go to hell. I definitely had those experiences on the playground. But I feel like the thing that made you most an outcast from the world is that you were an extreme theater nerd, and you have an entire musical about your relationship with musicals in the book. You can go to a website and listen to it during the middle of the book. That's really what shaped you, I think, even more, was this theater nerddom. And you started making parody music and comedy music, and people like your boyfriend were like, that's great. But then one of your music videos, I believe, went viral.
Yeah.
Can you talk to me a little bit about going viral and what that felt like?
Well, it was the first. So it was actually the first music video I put online. I'd only been doing comedy music for a relatively short amount of time. And what I was trying to do was just establish myself as a comedian in like the local New York City comedy scene. And people had been kind of doing stuff at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater simultaneously with putting stuff online. And I was like, oh, I can do that too. So this music video, Fuck Mary Bradbury, went viral. And it was at a time when the aesthetic of like what went quote unquote viral. First of all, it was in the middle, the kind of beginning middle of like the internet sketch comedy boom. Right. Cause when Funny or Die, you had the sketch, The Landlord with Funny or Die, I want to say in maybe 2000. Actually, you know, what really started. It was Lonely Island's Lazy Sunday in, I believe, 2005.
Yeah. I was going to say Lonely Island. Yeah.
So like that started, the internet is a whole way that sketch comedy can completely thrive, and you can post one-off things and a lot of people will see them. And then you had Funny or Die and you had the sketch, The Landlord. And yes, it was Will Ferrell, but still it was just uploaded to this website. And then comedians started thinking, I can just post like sketches online and I don't need a gatekeeper. I don't need someone to tell me, yes, I will make your sketch comedy show for HBO or whatever.
Right.
But the aesthetic of comedy was still very much like kind of shitty looking camera, like very, very handheldy. Like it didn't look.
First of all, leave me alone.
Uh-huh. Were you doing stuff at that time?
I gotta look it up.
But like that was the aesthetic. It was like everyone has their cameras and the cameras are fine. But then I feel like it was the Canon 5D / the Canon 7D came out, and suddenly you could get a camera that made things look really beautiful or relatively beautiful for not a lot of money. And so people were then starting to make sketches that looked a little more professional. And so when I made this music video, I paid my friend Paul, who was the DP. Actually, it was two Pauls. Paul was the director, and then another Paul was the DP. I paid the director and the DP like $400 each. I mean, I truly robbed them.
Yes.
But because our DP was so good at what he did, and he was so used to being like a one-man band, I didn't have a grip or a gaffer or whatever. He just came with his equipment, and I had some friends who were unpaid PAs like help him out. And I think because the video looked so good, it went viral. And it took me by surprise. I didn't think it would go viral in the way it did. And I didn't think it would earnestly resonate with science fiction fans and fantasy fans the way that it did. And I just remember that first day being holed up in my friend's apartment, like responding to every single Facebook message, saying like, great video, and responding with, thank you so much. I think I got Twitter specifically to engage in the video going viral. It was how I learned what a hashtag was. And then I remembered a certain point, I was like, I'm going to sell the song, but I felt guilty for selling, for making money from comedy. So I put up a link to the song on iTunes. I was like, proceeds towards, this song will go towards my next music video. Like I felt dirty
doing that,
making money from an internet sketch.
Yeah.
But it happened so quickly, and it's how I got an agent. It's how I got managers. It led me to my first comedy writing job. Like it was this huge deal.
Yeah. So because of this video, and this is one of the key questions that I think relates to this podcast, you found yourself in writers' rooms and dealing with male writers specifically of a very particular kind. And I on this podcast, we talk to women about what it's like to be in their fields. And I think this is the moment that I'm really curious about. Can you talk about the experience of being a woman in a writer's room dominated by loud, entitled men?
Yeah, well, there were a couple of other variables in it. Taking a sip of water, because I want to be prepped. So the first thing is that I was the only girl on the staff. I was also by far I was the youngest person on the staff. And I was the only person who it was their first job, professional job working in comedy. Everyone else had already worked in comedy. They'd already just built up that kind of that nerve. I'm like, okay, I've been on a writing staff before. I can go in with some confidence. And here I was coming off of, at the time, I only had one music video online. I got the job based off of a spec of the show 30 Rock. I was 23 years old. I was really young. I mean, I went in being insecure. I remember asking my lawyer, what if I'm not good at this job?
Right,
you know,
right.
What's the excuse? Like I did go in scared. And I remember there was a period of 3 days, my first week on the job, that I did really well, actually. Like my first day there, I felt really confident. And then after that, I started to get torn down. And it was guys who were older than I was. And it wasn't a monolith. Like some of them were very nice, but it was just really these two guys, and then the kind of like two other guys who let them say whatever they wanted, who were like very funny but very mean. And their way of being, basically the funnier they were feeling, the more they would interrupt and cut down everyone else. And and especially me, because I was new, my pitches weren't like amazing sometimes, as what happens when you have a new young person, and they would like make fun of me for having like bad pitches. So would they have done that if I were a guy? Maybe. But I think that what we're talking about is the pressure of the patriarchy.
Right.
Because they learned this is what I use my comedy to assert dominance over other people, that I can't be funny It, like, me being funny and sharp, it also means, like, me asserting myself as funnier than other people. And that's, like, a big comedian thing. Like, I'm not naive. A lot of comedians do that. But this room was particularly, like, really mean. And but the thing is, no one was like, fuck off, you're not funny. It was all this, like, they'd be mean in the room and they'd be like, come play poker with us.
Right.
So they'd like, or, and then they'd be like, we know we're assholes to you, you know? So it wasn't like the straight up bullying that you expect from a bully. It was like, there were things that made me think, is this just me? Am I imagining this? And the boss actually had a couple talks where he was like, I know this is like a mean room and so-and-so is kind of a bully. And so that helped me feel like, okay, I'm not insane. And then a few times my husband was around me and these guys and he'd be like, these guys hate you.
Yeah.
which really helped. Like, well, I mean, he was my boyfriend at the time, but now my husband, but like it helped because, and ashamedly, I think I needed to have another guy say, yeah, these guys are mean.
Yeah.
I don't know if I would have felt as validated in my feelings had it been a woman.
Wow.
Who was like, you're right, these guys are mean. It took another straight white dude to be like, yeah, those guys are fucking assholes. You're right.
So you survived this experience. You even got to talk back to some of the men in those rooms, but that's a whole different story. You have to get the book for it. But fast forward a little bit, you came up with an idea for a television show called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. You started co-creating this show. And I think this is such a fascinating moment because I think a lot of people think that when opportunities come to you, you have to be prepared. You have to be the one to do the job. You have to be trained. And you were not ready. Everything was chaos. And it all happened on a timeline that was absolutely absurd. I was wondering if you could like talk about what it's like to take on the biggest opportunity of your life when you are just completely not ready in so many ways.
Well, even the initial meeting when I got the email that Aline Brash McKenna saw my internet music videos and wanted to meet with me to discuss like doing a musical television show. Right. I was like, it's something that I'd wanted for a while. At that point, I'd been doing my music videos online. A lot of them had been self-funded. I had just released a self-funded album. And this is what I wanted, but like it still was really scary, even going into that meeting, because it suddenly was like a very big deal meeting that happened very quickly and unexpectedly. But going into the show actually getting ordered,
right?
I mean, I talk about this in the book, but I had a whole mental health journey before we shot the pilot,
right?
And the way I kind of learned to deal with pressure and the pressure of this crazy thing is happening and I'm not prepared is just to, I got very philosophical and global with it, which is like, you know what? You only live once. Just ride the roller coaster. It's yeah, okay. Yeah. Like trying to get myself out of the perspective of this is it. This is destiny. It's yours to fuck up. You know, in the story of your life that is the movie, this is either the moment where you triumph or you have a downward spiral. Trying to get myself out of those fixed narratives and being like, no, just live in the present, live in the moment. Life does not work like that. I mean, we have a literal song in Crazy Ex called like,
yeah,
life doesn't make narrative sense. That yeah, actually yeah, was really calming and helped me to be like, no, like, I learned something from my psychiatrist where it's like, you're not a psychic. You don't yeah, know what's going to happen. So don't try to imagine all of these bad outcomes. Don't imagining all the ways you can fuck something up. Even if you fuck it up, you're going to fuck it up in a way you could have never imagined. So it's a waste of time to
no, say thank you for that thought. That's going to return to me now.
I know. I'm so sorry. But like all you can do is, you know, do your best in any given moment and
yeah,
ride the roller coaster and future you is not some different person. I think this is what I had to realize. Like when I think when I'd have anxiety about like me fucking something up, it was almost like this imaginary person who had suddenly gone insane, right? And right. was, yes. and it's like, no, it's you. And you know you, you're you right now. So just like, think about the evidence. It's like, if you're gonna think about something, think about all of the reasons in that and all of the evidence of all of the ways in your life you haven't massively fucked shit up.
Yeah.
And so you kind of try to like, I mean, for me, it's not engaging in the anxiety is what I learned. Whenever I tried to outsmart the anxiety, it just got me spiraling more and more.
Yes.
That's why just being in the present, being like, well, this is a fucking roller coaster. Just like YOLO, ride it.
Which
like
you love roller coasters. So.
I do love, and I love them. But just to be like, I'm living in the present. I'm living in the moment. All I can do is be myself in the moment. And if I, and then I think in the back of my head, it's like, if anything gets fucked up, then I can just talk about that openly someday and be like, yeah, that got fucked up, you know?
Yeah.
And that's kind of how I approach live performance, especially when we were doing like Crazy X Live is like, I don't know, if I fucked up a line or I cracked, I'd just be like, well, I cracked. And that it's fine. It's not a fuck up. It's part of the show.
Yeah, that's like when people ask me, they're like, in season 10, you were so in your head without, and then in All Stars 5, you were so much more confident with no doubts. I'm like, that's actually not what happened at all. What happened was I had the exact same doubts and I just crowd surfed on them instead of like bowing to them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
they're absolutely. Still there.
And I think people think you have to defeat your inner demons. No, you learn to kind of dance with them, I guess.
I love crowd surfing on your doubts is such a fucking cool image. I've never heard that, and I'm going to think about, I'm going to use that as like a self-soothing, as something, a way to self-soothe myself in the future. Self-soothe myself. Right. That's right. I wrote a book. Because they never away.
When you write a book, you have an editor. Thank God.
Yes. Oh my God. Because it never goes away. It's just kind of, and I think that not freaking out when you feel those things, and that dovetails into how I now deal with like intrusive thoughts whenever they come up, because they'll come up still sometimes, and it can be about different things. It's at the end of the day, it's the fear of my own anxiety or my own intrusive thoughts. I'm gonna fuck this up for myself. That's really the core of my anxiety / like intrusive thoughts. And so what I've learned is just like, all right, that's here. Like it's just, I had a voice teacher who one time was talking about anxiety, and he was from the South, and he's like, you know, sometimes a bird's going to get in your barn and you don't make a nest for it and you don't try to swat away at it. Just like, let the bird be there, and eventually the bird will fly out. I thought that was a great way to describe cognitive behavioral therapy.
Yeah. Is that how you approach periods where you're out of ideas? Because you kind of talked about that fear a little bit in your book, where you'll get to these points where after, what did you create? 157 songs for Crazy Ex-Girlfriend.
Yeah.
It's like, is this approach, this philosophy, how you dealt with those periods where you were empty brained? Do you know what I mean?
Well, luckily, I mean, Crazy Ex was such an ensemble effort. I get a lot of the credit for it, as I should, but there were three songwriters. It was me, Jack Dolgen, and of course the late Adam Schlesinger.
Adam,
So we always were working as a team, even when it was like someone just wrote a song themselves. We were always punching up each other's work. There was always as far as like the specific fear of running out of song ideas, there was always a cushion because there were two other people who I loved and really, really respected. The place where I ran me ragged on Crazy X was the things that only I could do. So I supervised the edit of every music video. And I was the person that like did that. Like I would end up doing, sitting with the editor and doing the passes on the music videos. And then of course acting in the show. Yeah. And that was always really scary, although that actually just kept me going. the schedule was insane, but the thing that kept me doing the schedule was I had no choice. It's right. Either I do the schedule or there's no more television show. So like what, and the few times that I couldn't go on, there were a few times that I got very sick, which I'm something I'm hoping that happens due to COVID is that we pressure people to work when they're sick less. Cause I had kissing with people when I was sick and vice versa. And that should not be happening. But I felt like the schedule kept me going so that I just kind of had to do it, when I watch Drag Race, I have a lot of thoughts. I try to like think about that schedule and I compare it to the Crazy Ex schedule. Cause it seems like such a relentless, high stakes schedule. I mean, the thing that would have, especially a couple of years ago when I was dealing with my own anxiety about Crazy Ex being a pilot and my first kind of bout of success, is the thing that would have freaked me out doing Drag Race is, so I had like sleep anxiety that I was dealing with.
Yeah.
Especially like if I had an early morning.
Right.
Like I imagine you do like these late nights on Drag Race and then you have to wake up early the next day.
Yeah.
So the pressure of being like, okay, go to sleep now. I have to lip sync tomorrow and I have to make a dress tomorrow.
You have 6 hours. Yeah.
Like that would have been my main stress.
Yeah. Your chapter on, and this, if you guys get nothing else from this episode, I feel like it could be this. Like, if you want to know what it's like to make television, Miss Bloom's chapter on making television is just the most accurate description. Like, you have 5 minutes maybe in the bathroom before you have that text message like, hey, still in the bathroom? No pressure, just checking. And everything else is just like flitting back and forth between very, very cold rooms, fielding only questions and cameras. And I was just wondering if you could help me convince our listeners that sometimes making television or sometimes being in the middle of your lifelong dream, to make it more general, doesn't feel glamorous at the time.
No, because it's work. It's picture like your high school play. Yeah. It's making your high school play, except just on a heightened level and it being way harder. Yeah. Once you get used to being on a set, because there's no red carpet on the set. The set doesn't feel glamorous. The set is a workplace. Now with Drag Race, it's a little different because obviously you do have those moments of glamour, but I imagine many moments of glamour, of course, but like I imagine that like it felt kind of like on Crazy Ex when we were shooting the music videos. It's glamour, but like it's still for like you're still at work.
Yeah.
It's glamour for like a purpose. So it's stressful glamour. And also the cold set. Drag Race is by far the coldest set I've ever been on.
The coldest set I've ever been on in my life.
Okay, so I was like, why is it? So when I did Drag Race, I was 2.5 months pregnant.
Yeah.
So I was in the height of my body was just going crazy. I had morning sickness. I was nauseous like the whole day. At one point I was twerking with the pit crew in these stiletto Louboutins. And I was like, I'm dizzy. And I realized, oh, I haven't drunk water. And they said like, well, we keep the set cold because of the queens, because they're in so many layers. But like, if you're cold, then who is it cold for?
I don't know who it's called for, but I thought about that while I was reading your book, just talking about working in television equals going to different places with different circles of hell as far as being freezing. Like whether it's an award show or a cocktail mixer or on set, it's different kinds of freezing cold. And that's why in All Stars 5, you can see me wearing a giant like fur parka, faux fur.
Everybody, oh my God, of course. That's why you were wearing that amazing jacket, because it's fucking freezing, of course. Freezing. Oh, I was just like, that looks like a great jacket, but of course.
No! Yeah, if you were like, I think Rachel will agree with this, that if you are watching a television show and you're like, oh my God, it must be so amazing to do this. I wish I could do it. Yes, absolutely. But also think two things, cold and shapewear. And that should I should get you right together.
Well, and also you're fucking tucking. So like, wait, so on, okay, this is so, I've always wondered this on Untucked, you know, they obviously call it Untucked. Is there any point where you actually get to like fully untuck?
No, ma'am.
And, yeah, that's what I thought, right? It's not like you actually like, when Ruth says go up back, untuck backstage, for you to untuck and then get back into drag, that's a whole, that would be a whole thing.
Right. Yep. It's, you are not untucked. In fact, that's why probably some of the best fights happen untucked, because on Untucked, because you have been tucked and you are, your body is looking for any kind of release that you can find. And sometimes that's throwing drinks at people.
What's the like, wait, I have to, cause I've worn shapewear corsets and Spanx.
Yeah.
And like, I find that it's, I don't know, it starts to really hurt after 4 hours.
Did you
find that being on Drag Race like upped your like tucking shapewear tolerance?
I used to have trouble like sitting in rooms by myself, and then like Drag Race trained me that, you know, you can do anything. No pain or solitude like right. is too much. And I think it did the same thing for me with shapewear. I just got like, I was like, you know, pain is life. You know, like it would drain
wow.
you. But I remember specifically for Crazy X Live, Caitlin will remember this too. I was wearing like a full, like nipples to testicles corset. And I was sitting in the audience, and we hit that like 4 hour mark, and I just like started bleeding out of my eyes, and I was like, why did I course it to sit down? Like, what was the what was the thing? And so, as I left Crazy X Live, I like ran down to the bathrooms, and I like actually like half stripped in the lobby because I was just like,
really?
Yeah, it was just like, yeah. So I think you can build your tolerance to shapewear, but you will never fully get over it. You will never fully get over it.
Do you find, because sometimes there are, I don't know, if I've been doing, especially on Crazy X, if I was doing a lot of events in a row, I would find dresses that with which I didn't have to wear Spanx and be like, oh, this is great. Do you sometimes look for dresses or outfits where you wouldn't have to tuck?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Why do you think I wear a big bow and a like a floofy poodle skirt with every with every
oh,
outfit?
That's so
I am
smart.
Fully, yeah, I'm fully just like, we got lots of tulle. Yeah, that is absolutely, especially because I don't know about you, but I'm a person that pees every hour on the hour.
They had to build it into the Crazy X schedule. I peed so yeah. much.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, God.
Right. Like, oh, my God. Wait, if you have to pee and you're tucked, like, what do you do?
I always told myself that if I wrote a book about my drag experience, it would be called I Can't Pee Till Tomorrow. And that's because that's what I think every time I tuck. I'm like, well, goodbye, genitalia. I'll see you like tomorrow in the AM. Like, it is the craziest feeling. And you just learn to live with your eyeballs floating. And
oh my God, that's so like, that's like, it's just, it's interesting because you hear a lot about like, okay, women wore corsets and, you know, for right. all of human history and that corsets at a certain point when they were restrictive with like whalebone, they started to really like fuck up your insides. Does tucking have any health? And forgive me if I don't mean to like, be the person being like, tell me about how what you do to your dick. Are there any like long-term health repercussions you have to worry about if you're tucking?
The only thing I can tell you is that when I first started drag, I tuck with duct tape, and it used to hurt all day long. My tuck used to hurt so bad. And then one day I was tucking, I pulled really tight, and there was this weird like internal ripping noise. And then it never hurt again.
Oh my God.
And so I was like, it's a blessing, yes, that it doesn't hurt anymore. But I'm wondering what that was that I said goodbye to. And actually, that leads me to my next question for you.
Great.
Because you would
Please ask anything, because that was a very interesting story. And thank you for sharing that.
Oh, and just the noise inside. That's what it's like. You hear it through your own bones.
Oh, my God.
So I feel like you can identify, because in writing 157 songs about life, you and your team wrote about pretty much every painful and embarrassing thing. And one of the things you wrote about was the miracle of birth. The miracle of birth. And my sister wanted to know, because she is a new mother as well, how did it feel going into the experience, realizing that you had written about it? Did the experience stack up to the song? Like,
yes, I went in. I think I went into the entire experience of at least being pregnant and giving birth, probably being one of the more educated, like, first time moms.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah,
at least of people I knew, because. So Miracle of Birth was actually written by Jack and Adam. I didn't have a hand in it because it was the part of the season where I was just under, I was slammed on set. So that was all Jack and Adam. Jack and Adam interviewed the women in the writer's room who are moms. We had a majority moms writer's room.
Yes.
And Jack actually had a document on his computer, I think, that was like horror stories. And they based the song off of the real, and then Adam had two daughters, so he'd been through seeing his wife give birth, and so that song was based on like all of the most intense stories and experiences from the women. But I'd been hearing those stories for 4 years. My writing partner Aline has two kids. Like our costume designer has two kids. Like I'd heard a lot of birth stories, and then that song kind of being the culmination of it. And I'm interested in body stuff too. I always found pregnancy really, really interesting. Right. So when I went into it, I think the song really prepared me. And I was really prepared. Like actually the last text conversation that I have with Jack and Adam, because the first lyric is your cervix has been closed and plugged with mucus, but soon that viscous plug will be discharged.
Yeah.
The day that my mucus plug started to shed, I texted Jack and Adam. I was like, hey guys. And Adam said, that's mucus to my ears.
That's terrible.
Oh. He and Jack just together, the most wonderful, cringiest puns you could ever hope for. But yeah, I was really prepared. And then I toured a little bit when I was pregnant. And my friend Danny Jollis, who played George on the show, was my stand-up opener. Yeah. And in some of the shows,
yes,
I had Danny sing The Miracle of Birth to me.
Yes.
As part of my show. And it was this very weird... he's like, listen, as a man, I just have some advice. And it was just this very weird moment, because there were moments where like, oh, this song is gruesome and I'm going to have to go through this. And it's partially why I knew I wanted an epidural.
That's perfect. By the way, my other podcast, As a Man, I Have Some Advice, will be coming out in January. speaking of the most painful things that a human being can go through, things that there aren't an epidural for.
Nice segue. Online
hate.
Oh my God.
I love your chapter on online hate. I think it's an inspiration for the age. And I was wondering if, like, because I obviously, everyone deals with it. I deal with it. Can you tell me what your social media philosophy and practice is right now? Because I feel like I need help at this moment.
Yeah. Oi. Well, first of all, like, anything I've been through, I think, pales in comparison with anyone who's been on Drag Race. I mean, the toxicity of some of those fans. That's all. That scares me. I don't think I'd be able to handle it. I'm torn about social media. I don't keep Instagram and Twitter on my phone most of the time. Especially when promoting my book, I'd like schedule a lot of posts. Like you can schedule posts. Like if you're promoting your shit through that, you know, that website Hootsuite. I know what it does to me, which is what it does to everyone, but it affects me especially where like, you know, I look at Instagram and then 3 hours have gone by. I feel the addiction. I feel my eyeballs burning. I feel the need for dopamine. I think the more followers you get, the more you crave that attention. Like it's chemical. This stuff is like, it's gambling. It's chemically addictive.
That's right.
And social media has like so many positives, but its implications for like mental health, I think are really troubling and worrisome. So what I try to do is I try to keep it off my phone and I try to use it for mostly promotional purposes. Not always. I'll post like personal pictures and like, sometimes it's really fun. It's really fun to do an Instagram live. It feels
to show your dog
good.
With an award.
Yeah, exactly. Like it feels cause Vegas is fun. It's fun to play a couple of hands in blackjack. It's fun to like get drunk. Like, you know, all of these things in moderation are like guilty pleasures. Yes. But still pleasures. So I try to live it in moderation and I also try to like constantly live in the hypocrisy of it. And that like, I think a lot of it's wrong, but I still do it and engage in it because I frankly need to. For my job and to promote my shit. And there are also a lot of wonderful things that come from it. I just don't, when I do it in excess, it fucks with my brain. And you see it, you see people get, my psychiatrist, I quote him on the back of the book saying one thing, but in the session, when I was talking to him and I asked if I could quote him, he's like, here's another quote for you. Social media brings out the worst in everybody. And I bless his heart. I think he thought he was being like really clever when he said that. I think he sometimes doesn't, he's a really smart person. I think sometimes he doesn't realize when he's being profound and the things he thinks are profound aren't as profound.
You're like, let me decide. I'll decide
what to quote.
Yeah.
But it does. Like the high of posting and the need for constant attention, it brings out the worst in everybody. And the constant use of the hashtag inspo, empowered, all of that shit. I'm amazed for how smart people are now and how like, how much like awareness there is of like other people's social media accounts and not even like cancel culture, but like everyone is kind of on alert. There's so the little amount of shit that's given to people who like put 1,000 hashtags in every post, the little amount of shit that's given to the kind of shallow sincerity that makes up a lot of social media. And it's because it's positive, right? So you don't want to shit on something that's positive. And I don't openly shit on people who are being positive, but I think it brings out the grossest parts of people because it's just about the attention and it's just about the likes and it's just about the retweets. And I feel myself getting sucked into it. Yeah. And I feel myself reading the mentions. And then you get distracted by the one bad thing in the sea of all of the good things. It's and I think the thing that I've learned that's helped me emotionally is I used to get upset at a mean comment and then feel ashamed. Be like, what? It's just the internet. Why I'm upset?
Right.
And no, it's okay. Like if someone is mean to you online, you're not silly for getting upset. You're a human being. Like I think that other people being like, oh, it's the internet. Who fucking cares? But then, all right, if it's the internet, who fucking cares? Then why do we put so much stock on what's on the internet? Clearly Literally, we care a great deal. And to read in print a terrible thing about you, so what if it's like a troll living in his mom's basement or whatever? That doesn't matter. It's still been said to you in print and it fucking hurts. So I think putting the emotion back in all of that shit is very key and humanizing everyone.
I really like that idea that, you know, you shouldn't punish yourself for suffering. It just adds another layer that you don't need. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. And it stigmatizes getting your feelings hurt when someone's like, fuck you. I wish you'd fucking die. Like, yeah, that hurts. That hurts. We shouldn't be saying that to each other. No one should have that said to them, except for, you know, the Trumps. You know, they should have trolling because Donald Trump is killing people. I'm trying to quantify that. Like, well, no, I don't want him to die. And, you know, I'm trying to get ahead of.
Okay, now as a journalist, I have my headline for this podcast, Rachel calls for the death of. Thanks. We've got our little soundbite, Rachel.
Oh my God, you're welcome. Happy to help. Happy to help.
Here she set fire to the White House.
I guess what I'm saying is most people who aren't ignoring a pandemic and putting children in cages, who have horrible things said to them, the punishment does not fit the crime. And right. Even when it does, that shit fucking hurts. And to pretend like it doesn't hurt, or to pretend like, well, if it hurts you, then you're just too sensitive. That's bullshit. I think that it should be more like, don't say that shit to people.
Yeah.
Like we're getting so, the internet makes people so callous, and that callousness and that black and white thinking, it's wrong. And I don't know how to reconcile the hypocrisy with the fact that I talk about this, but yet I'm still on. But the least I can do is I try to get sucked up in reading comments. I try to put a time limit, and really having it off of my phone helps a great deal.
I have to ask you.
Yes.
I had the honor of seeing your Crazy Ex live, and it made me wonder, and especially after reading this book, do you see Crazy Ex or another Bloom project ever going to Broadway?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. There's something I'm working on now. I'm working on the Nanny musical as a writer, but no, there are numerous projects that I'm like in various stages of development. I definitely want to go to Broadway at some point if they'll have me.
Oh, I'm so excited. Thank you so much for talking with me today. This has been truly wonderful. Everyone get this book. If you haven't watched Crazy Ex, not possessive, Crazy Ex, please get into it.
Wait, my burning question for you.
Yeah.
Because again, when I watch Drag Race, I think about what would make me anxious. Okay. When you have the musical numbers, including on the finale, do you get to do it more than once? That's my burning question.
You get to do it twice.
Okay, that's great. That's a relief.
Right? And
that's what I would tell myself. I'd be like, it's okay. You get to do it two times.
You get
like
to do it
that,
two times.
It like little outs like that would help my anxiety. That's really good.
You know what's the funny thing is though? And like, there's like a life lesson hidden in here. That first time when you are sure you're going to mess it up and you're so terrified, you nail it. It's the second time when you're confident that you mess it up. And I just think that like that's so much of life. That terror can actually help you, and comfort can be your downfall. Just like as if you've ever done theater, that first night is the glory night, and the second night when you're all like, "Oh, we did it before," that's when that's when all the problems start.
Absolutely, that makes so much sense. Thank you. I needed to know that.
Don't worry, it's still terrifying for all those Drag Race fans. Don't worry, we're still terrified.
Then you have to sew. I mean, the sewing. Well, anyway, that's my podcast, is help me talk me through my anxiety while I'm watching Drag Race.
Yes! I'll have my people call your people so that we can put together Miss Cracker calms Rachel Bloom's nerves
So you got a day off, right? Like so for Snatch Game, like, okay, you got to bring multiple wigs. Okay, that's good.
And I'll bring a list of everything we ate, just so you know. Bathroom break and then macaroni and cheese.
Oh, okay, good. Okay, you got to eat. That's good.
You're a nice Jewish mother now, and that's it.
No, I just worry for everybody on there.
Thank you so much, Rachel. Thank you for taking time today, for cramming yourself in your closet. And everybody, watch the show, get the book. That's all I can say. Oh, my goodness. That was such a
great experience. We talked for an hour about Jewy stuff, theater stuff, crazy ex-girlfriend, social media, like all the things that are on my mind all the time.
Yeah, she's really a kindred spirit, I feel.
Oh, I feel too. And I could just imagine her like curled up in the closet. Like,
oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
As like there's a baby probably crying outside, but
yes.
She's in the closet, you know, exactly. Having her get me the fuck out of here moment.
Exactly, yes. Oh, so I don't know. I feel like I've said this 30 times in the last 30 minutes, but if you haven't watched Crazy Ex-Girlfriend yet, go watch, because it like whatever your thing that makes you different is, it's covered.
It brings lightness to things that are heavy.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
And that's really refreshing.
Yeah. Wait, I have a whole setup now. I have a whole script for when we're done.
Oh.
Yeah. We're getting organized
now.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. So we're actually going to take a quick break now, but we'll be right back. Okay, we're back, and it's time for the end of the episode, Caitlin. Oh my God, I'm dropping things. It's time for the end of the episode, Caitlin. So, first of all, I want to say this. If you liked your time with us today, and you're enjoying that buzzing noise that's happening in the background, make sure to subscribe, rate, and review this podcast. We love reviews. In fact, we love them so much, we're going to read some of our favorite reviews right here at the end of the show, starting in 2021.
Wait, I was going to suggest that.
You were going to suggest that?
But then I never did, but I was like, I've seen other podcasters do that and might prompt more people to make reviews.
Oh,
because we're
going
to give them special attention.
Caitlin, our minds.
I know.
Our minds. Anyway, enough about that. It's time for the credits. This podcast was produced by Caitlin Gredham, and then I did it. The cast includes me and also Caitlin, and it is distributed by the amazing Studio 71. So thank you for joining us today. Make sure to tune in next Monday for another exciting episode. And remember, if you ever feel down, all you have to do is look in the mirror and say, "She's a woman!" And I'll be with you.
I feel like we need to go to sleep.
Oh, absolutely.